Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the President's Day edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, with what Jim is calling the all-apocalyptic edition of the Three Martini Lunch today, and we're not that far off, given what we're going to be talking about today. And you can probably guess, without us even telling you, what a couple of those topics will be. Jim, we start with the stunning news on Saturday, just a few hours before the Republican debate, that longtime Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, the stalwart of the conservatives, had died while at a hunting ranch in West Texas. 79 years old. He had been on the court since 1986, more than 29 years. He was the longest serving justice on the court at the time of his passing. Jim, I've been thinking about this over the weekend, and I'm sure folks could come up with different names that they would think would better fit this. But given Scalia's reputation on the bench as a stalwart textualist, as an ardent defender of the Constitution, and yes, of course, coming down with an interpretation of the Constitution that conservatives like, his death is perhaps the most politically consequential death in this country since John F. Kennedy, given the timing of it and given the potential impact of it as to how this plays out with the replacement or non-replacement here in the coming months. But his legacy of brilliance, his legacy of faithfully applying the Constitution and not sticking his finger in the wind has been very, very popular on the federal bench at all different levels over the past several years. The loss of Antonin Scalia, even before you get to the politics of replacing him, is monumental.
One of the persons I was speaking to this weekend, Greg, described it as a gut punch. And I think that's the way most people felt when they saw the news Saturday afternoon. It felt like a gut punch to the conservative cause. It felt like a gut punch to the vision Republicans have, and it just feels like a gut punch for the country. A couple quick thoughts on the legacy of Scalia. Yes, he was, you know, the court's conservative, one of the most outspoken conservatives, but really, even his worst enemies will point out that he was a, you know, just a towering intellectual giant. This was a smart guy. And unlike a lot of smart legal minds, he could write and speak and argue and make his arguments with remarkable clarity. People talk about his sense of humor and sometimes a very sharp sarcasm to his rejoinders and remarks and assessments. This was a guy who, you know, look, legal briefs are not always fun to read, but sometimes, you know, you could really enjoy at least usually the closing paragraph of an Antonin Scalia opinion. He was, you know, he was a sharp mind. There's great intellectual rigor there, and it kind of feels like we're losing that in our culture and in our society, this tendency to just slam each other and name call and all that kind of stuff. Separately, there's a good point worth noting that he and Ruth Bader Ginsburg were good friends. That as much as he was a guy who fought passionately and intensely for the causes he believed in, he never seemed to do it with a way that alienated people and made enemies, or at least those his colleagues on the court. Apparently, Ginsburg and Scalia used to go over each other's houses and travel together and do things like that. It was kind of a fascinating friendship to look at there. So we have a towering legal giant gone. The Supreme Court can operate with eight justices. If there is a 4-4 split, then whatever lower court decision was made stays in place. And some people won't like that. We'll see what happens with the confirmation. But it's very tough to imagine a scenario that gives us a better Supreme Court than the one we had with Scalia sitting on the bench.
That's certainly the case. And there will be a time for reflection over the coming days ahead as we mourn the passing of Justice Scalia. But just when you thought you had kind of a sense of where things were headed in the final year of this administration and with this campaign, as you said, a gut punch and a major curveball. And that also applied to the Republican debate on Saturday night as we switched to our second apocalyptic martini. Everyone across the stage asked to react to the passing of Scalia and what that would mean for what the Senate should be doing over the next several months and what they would do if elected president in terms of deciding what type of justice should be on the Supreme Court. And everyone seemed to be in agreement with Mitch McConnell and Mike Lee and Ted Cruz that the Republicans should not allow an Obama appointee to be on the Supreme Court this close to the end of his administration. And that's a debate that obviously will continue for some time. But that's not the headline out of Saturday night's debate. This is definitely the roughest, the ugliest, the most liar accusations thrown on, And unfortunately, that gave John Kasich a lot of opportunities to say, hey, come on, folks, we need to just get along. And when I'm president, everyone will love each other. The two big moments both involved Donald Trump, who was definitely amped up for this thing. And it also led to a number of statements from him that normally, if conventional wisdom was anywhere close to applying, should give some of his supporters reason for pause. And we'll find out on Saturday if it did give them reason for pause. Here's one moment where Ted Cruz and Donald Trump mixed it up over Planned Parenthood funding, because Cruz was saying that Trump was all over the map on this and eventually was opposed to defunding Planned Parenthood, which led to this exchange.
Where did I support it?
You supported it when we were battling over defunding Planned Parenthood. You went on
television and said
Planned Parenthood does wonderful things and we should not defund
it. Well, it does do wonderful things, but not as it relates to abortion.
So tell me, what are the wonderful things it does?
There are wonderful things having to do with women's health.
You see, you and I disagree on that.
There's that mainstream position, Jim, of all the wonderful things Planned Parenthood does other than the hundreds of thousands of abortions a year. But the one that's really getting attention is this dust-up with Trump and Jeb Bush. John Dickerson brought up the point to Trump that in 2008, Donald Trump said that Nancy Pelosi should have called for the impeachment of George W. Bush over lying over the war in Iraq. Now, Trump has mentioned that he's been always against the war in Iraq, and that's a fairly safe position these days in the Republican Party. But then it just escalated and escalated. Here's how it went.
George Bush made a mistake. We can make mistakes, but that one was a beauty. We should have never been in Iraq. We have destabilized the Middle East.
But so you still think he should be impeached?
I think it's my turn, isn't it?
You do whatever you want. You call it whatever you want. I want to tell you, they lied.
Okay.
They said there were weapons of mass destruction. There were none, and they knew there were none.
While Donald Trump was building a reality TV show, my brother was building a security apparatus to keep us safe, and I'm proud of what he did. And he's had the gall to go after
World Trade Center came down.
He's had the gall to go after my mother.
Remember that.
And a lot of crosstalk there at the end. So, Jim, we've gone from Trump being opposed to the Iraq war, which is, like we said, a fairly safe position, to now saying that Bush lied about the intelligence about weapons of mass destruction. So, in other words, the old liberal bumper sticker, Bush lied, people died. And now 9/11 is George W. Bush's fault, too. So I guess Michael Moore could have gotten some traction in this year.
I was going to say, it sounds like a joke when I say Code Pink issued a statement applauding Donald Trump, the Republican presidential frontrunner. But no, that genuinely happened this weekend. I think one of the things that bothers me the most about what happened Saturday night, Greg, is like, look, we had just heard about Scalia's death. And as I mentioned in the previous martini, here's a man who brought seriousness and intellectual rigor to the great legal questions of the day. And people thought that, okay, well, you know, look, this coming upon the heels of this shocking news, that the debate would take a more somber and serious tone. It would be more focused. It would be a debate worthy of Scalia. And we got, I think, precisely the opposite. I think that it was a it looked like a clown show. It looked like a car crash. Use whatever metaphor you like. Trump was at his Trumpiest, his loudest, his angriest, most frequently interrupting other candidates. You know, it didn't help whoever did his makeup decided to make him like one shade past Oompa Loompa orange. So, you know, we saw he was yelling until he was red in the face. He was red faced the moment he went onto that stage, and he's against a red background. It was a very odd visual dynamic there. And so I think it just, if you were a casual voter tuning in and you saw those guys shouting at each other, it looked like a reality show fight. It looked like amateur hour. It didn't look like anybody you'd want to entrust with the presidency during a time of increasing anxiety. Trump brought the tone of the debate down really fast, and it got ugly amongst all the candidates. And the debate audience was much noisier than it had been for past ones. Trump complained that the debate audience had been stacked against him with party apparatchiks. I don't know if that's necessarily the case, but there was a time in these early debates where they'd ask the audience to remain quiet. I think the whole thing ended up being pretty bad. The audience numbers are pretty good. We'll see if it changes things. But I think it's safe to say there's a good chance that a Republican candidate who contends that Bush could have or should have prevented 9/11, and that he knew that Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction and launched a war anyway, is now the Republican frontrunner. And unless there's a dramatic change in the numbers in South Carolina, that is the case. Life is going to go in a very unexpected direction in this cycle, and I don't know, it just feels more uncertain than ever.
I would say that given everything we've already seen in this campaign, I wouldn't be shocked if not many of his supporters actually had second thoughts given that point. I agree with your point about the audience, and I think ultimately the only thing that's going to derail Trump is the number of people who may get out after South Carolina or certainly after Super Tuesday, as long as there's six people in this race. Given the depth of support for him by that 30-ish percent of the electorate right now, as long as there's a handful of candidates in this field, I don't see that much is going to change from state to state. But all right, on to the last martini and back to Scalia. And Jim, unfortunately, we are in an ugly moment in American society, and it's a moment that's lasted far longer than it should. On the left, you had some of the most despicable comments about Justice Scalia that you could possibly imagine. It even got so bad that at one point, Clarence Thomas's name was trending on Twitter because that's how many liberals tweeted in to say they hoped he was next. And so you've got that going on the left. And then on the right, and perhaps elsewhere, who knows, conspiracy theories popping up because this happened at a ranch in Texas and he was away from home and he didn't have a security detail with him. And now Drudge Report banners of Scalia found dead with pillow overhead. So, Jim, we don't know the details here, but the fact that everyone wants to jump to a conclusion with this Alex Jones-style assuming nefarious business that Obama somehow had a Supreme Court justice whacked without any real evidence whatsoever just shows that while the internet can be a good thing in keeping people informed, it can be a real bad thing, too.
I mean, look, if you find it really odd and suspicious that a portly 79-year-old man dies in his sleep, you don't know much about human physiology and age and actuarial tables and things like that. One of the last I had heard that he'd had a heart attack, and considering the life of a Supreme Court justice, it doesn't seem all that unthinkable. I think it says something about the era that we're in, Greg, that I feel like people want to find an enemy. People want to find someone. It can't just be random chance. It cannot be cruel twists of fate. It has to be somebody out there who's doing this to us, who's causing bad things to happen. Because it's kind of the reason is that conspiracy theories are strangely reassuring. If you believe that 19 guys with box cutters could manage to kill 3,000 people in the United States on 9/11, then that's really terrifying, that it doesn't take a lot of people to get together and do something terrible and cause an enormous amount of misery and death and horror terrorize, you know, millions of people. All you have to do is uncover the vast conspiracy, and then justice will be done and this will never happen again. It does feel like the traditional rules of rationality are starting to erode. And I don't know whether this is if you encounter more people who think this way or whether more people are finding it reassuring to believe in conspiracy theories. Or, you know, I suppose you could say in an era where the NSA has been, you know, vacuuming up metadata and the IRS is targeting people, maybe paranoia has got a little more justification these days. Maybe all of a sudden people look at what things that actually do happen and say, oh, the idea of a vast conspiracy to control our lives and to do terrible things to people doesn't seem so unthinkable. Happy Apocalyptic Monday, everyone.
It was just Friday that we were playing spoof ads to Office Space. What the heck happened this weekend? Man.
Yeah. It's Valentine's Day. Valentine's Day and President's Day. It's too bad that they aligned too much.
Jim, on that note, it's got
on President's Day, it's no longer Washington's birthday or Lincoln's birthday. We wish them all together. So it means we're honoring all of America's presidents. Including Charles Logan.
Including Charles Logan. Now, that's a conspiracy that turned out to be true right there.
There you go.
Whacking his predecessor. So, anyway.
Everyone, enjoy your hemlock with your coffee this morning and your three martinis.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Tuesday for the next Three Martini Lunch.